and is a professor of political science at Concordia University College here in Edmonton, where she's taught international relations and comparative politics since 1989. And her publications and research projects have addressed the negotiation of investment agreements at the World Trade Organization and transnational movements of resistance to these agreements. Current projects include a study of the negotiation of international trade rules and standards for food labeling. And her most recent publication is In Whose Interest, Transparency and Accountability in the Global Governance of Food, Agribusiness, the Codex Alimentarius, and the World Trade, which is a chapter in the book edited by Jennifer Clapp and Dora Fuchs, I hope it's the right pronunciation there, Perfect Power in Global Agri-Food Governance, and Governance, MIT Press. So, welcome, Liz.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Leslie, and thank you, Athabasca University, for inviting me here this afternoon. I hope everybody can hear me, and I hope my slides will be legible. I perhaps will be speaking to some aspects of things on the slides, and I hope that if something is unclear, we can revisit it perhaps in the question period. Or since this is recorded, people can go back later and reference some of the slides. What I'm primarily interested in is food labeling, not from the perspective as it's often been addressed in terms of aspects of health, nutrition, and even safety as a sort of technical or marketing issue, but rather I'm looking at food labeling as a political struggle that involves the local, national, and global level, and an array of actors. And those actors include states that are regulating food labeling. In the case of Canada, that would be the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Corporations, particularly large transnational conglomerates that are often referred to as agribusiness. Non-governmental organizations, particularly consumer and environmental groups, as well as some peasant farmer groups globally, many of whom are trying to influence labeling and in some cases with a view to relocalizing the food system. And finally, international organizations that set food labeling standards, including the Codex Alimentarius, and trade organizations like the World Trade Organization that try and define what are legitimate instances of food labeling that do not impede international trade. I'm working on a series of case studies which include the labeling of foods containing genetically modified organisms and country of origin labeling. So I start with a basic question. Why do we want to know about where our food comes from and how it's produced? And what I would essentially argue is that eating is an inherently physically intimate and invasive act, necessary for our health and survival, but something that's also deeply embedded in local cultures and norms. So I'm taking the view that food is not just a product like any other, and that the labeling of food is inherently a sensitive and very political issue. The food system is now a global one, with increasing corporate concentration and vertical integration. I'm going to show you that a very small number of very large corporate actors control the production, transportation, processing, and distribution of food. This is just one example of the extent of corporate concentration in the food production system. These are just some figures provided by the National Farmers Union about wheat flour milling capacity in Canada. And you can see the large share of that milling capacity that is controlled by a very small number of companies, in particular Archer Daniels Midland. And this is very typical of many, many sectors. I hope you can read these slides, but you can see here who the top 10 food and beverage corporations are in the world. And many of these corporations are also dominant corporations within the Canadian food system or the U.S. food system. And again, you see Archer Daniels Midland there, Nestle, Kraft, Cargill. These would all be important actors in North America. These are just some statistics that come from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. And they indicate that about 30 companies account for one-third of global grocery sales. Agriculture Canada notes that there's very high levels of corporate concentration in supermarket chains. And then I've highlighted here one of their statistics that about 60% of national grocery sales in the late 1990s were controlled by five large retailers. And this has in fact increased since then. So this is just again an example of the extent to which the retail end of the food system is controlled by a very small number of corporate actors. This just again graphs a similar situation among many large industrialized countries. Sweden, Germany, France, the UK and Canada all have levels of concentration in terms of the market share of food retailers in excess of 60%. And again, the trend is for this to be increasing, not decreasing over time. What this shows you is one of the reasons I'll come back later to the positions that Canada has taken internationally on a number of controversial food labeling issues. The Canadian food processing sector is quite export oriented, and again, that's been overall increasing over time. In contrast to the United States, which actually, although it's a very important producer of various food crops, is in fact less globally integrated in its food production and processing than Canada is. So you can see that Canada has a quite a high level of integration into the global food system. What this again shows you is that food retailing is becoming more consolidated over time. The blue line is the number of stores, and the red line is the amount of sales. So as the amount of sales go up, the number of stores selling is actually going down. And more stores are now also selling their own corporate private labels, which is another reflection of the vertical integration that's occurring. These are some of the industry organizations that I look at in my work on GM and other types of food labeling. The Food and Consumer Products of Canada is an association of all of the major branded food producers and food labels. CropLife and Biotech Canada are industry associations of biotechnology firms that are very involved in the production of a number of crops in Canada that include genetically modified organisms. Now, in terms of international standards on food labeling, in my work, I'm examining the role of the Codex Alimentarius. This is a body that very few people know much about that was created jointly by the Food and Agricultural and World Health Organizations in 1962. Its mandate was to help countries harmonize their food standards and basically share best practices. Standards were very much voluntary standards that countries could adopt in their own national legislation if they chose to. But the role of the Codex changed quite a bit with the result of the establishment of the World Trade Organization in 1995. Because the World Trade Organization identifies what are justifiable and unjustifiable barriers to food trade, and they began referencing the Codex standards as the references to what were acceptable trade barriers. And what I mean by that is trade barriers that could not be challenged by other countries within the WTO. So in essence, if you exceed Codex standards, you're liable to be challenged in an international trade dispute, which, if you're a major exporter of a particular product, could be very costly. Canada is the chair of the Codex Committee on Food Labeling. And as the chair, Canada hosts the work each year of the committee when it meets annually. Canada is also a member of the Codex and directly involved in negotiations. And in that role, Canada has consistently opposed the labeling of genetically modified organisms in foods, and it has opposed country of origin labeling. In that capacity, Canada has rejected the principle, unlike the European Union and countries like Norway, Canada has rejected the principle of the consumer's right to know as a justification for mandatory labeling. This is probably a little difficult for some of you to read. It's just a standard food label, and I'm sure there are experts here on nutrition that could talk about the label. What I'm interested in is the issue of Product of Canada labeling. This is taken from a CBC Marketplace program where they created quite a stir when they showed that products could be labeled as Product of Canada based on the guideline that 51% of production costs were spent in Canada. In other words, you could have orange juice that comes from China, but if your packaging, your processing, your advertising, your costs incurred in Canada were greater than the actual cost of sourcing of the source or apple juice, you could claim that Chinese apple juice was a product of Canada.
Where do transportation costs fall under? Would Canada pick for? Are they attributed to the country that?
I think they're attributed to the importer who would be bringing the product in. So they could be part of that 51%. Yeah.
Yeah. And so these costs, you have a much higher cost. You know, make a mask for the Chinese, you know, labor. But I think by that, down to 2%, you can put almost everything, I think.
Absolutely, point well taken. If you think of anything, there have in fact been instances of tropical products that have been called Product of Canada. And again, canned pineapple, I understand, at some point was actually labeled this way. And I'll come back to this issue near the end. So what this marketplace program did, I think, was raised a lot of awareness about some of the rather strange and arbitrary nature of our labels.
I wonder if you know why it's good by cost, not by the ingredient or product?
I don't know the history of that. I will note this is changing. This will be changing. This was sort of a bit of a scandal that led to a parliamentary committee looking into this question, and the Harper government has indicated they are changing this labeling guideline. Okay. So I don't know the whole history of it, but my guess is that Industry Association on Food Processing had something to do with this labeling, but I can't document that at the moment, but that's my guess. The food labeling issues that I'm looking at are under the mandate of the Food Inspection Agency. Now, I realize there are some parts here highlighted in yellow. These are just the relevant acts of Parliament and guidelines that govern food labeling and the various fact sheets that are available on the CFIA website. The mandate of the CFI is to develop programs designed to encourage compliance with the provisions of the respective acts. And the acts in particular are Consumer Packaging and Labeling Acts, Food and Drug Acts, and Food and Drug Regulations. So this is just giving you a sense of who the regulatory agency is that's involved in food labeling. Now, the Food Inspection Agency carries a joint responsibility for federal food labeling. Health Canada also plays a role with respect to health and safety matters, which I'm not going to talk very much about. It's not an area that I know there are other people here have much greater expertise in that area. The CFIA is responsible for the non-health parts of labeling, which are the parts I'm interested in. The CFIA has a Fair Labeling Practices Program that administers and enforces these other aspects of labeling that I'm interested in. So one of the areas that I'm very interested in is why Canada opposed mandatory GM food labeling and why there is no mandatory labeling in Canada. One of the things that becomes very evident if you go back and look very much into the history of the battle over GM labeling in Canada and in the United States is that these are two countries that embraced biotechnology very early. They're what we would call early adapters. And they developed very, very close links between government, universities, and the biotechnology industry, and government departments and regulatory agencies. These are countries that are heavily invested in GM crop production. United States, Argentina, Canada, Brazil, and China account for the vast bulk of major GM crop production. Another part of the story is the movement of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency from the Department of Health to Agriculture Canada in 1997. Which really marginalized in some ways health's role somewhat on food regulations. Agriculture Canada is tasked with both promoting the food industry in Canada and regulating it, which you could argue creates in some areas a conflict of interest. The rest of the story has to do with some very important regulatory decisions that were made early on in the story of food labeling. What basically Canadian and American food regulating bodies accepted was an argument on the part of the industry and some scientists that if a genetically modified product can be compared systematically to an existing natural counterpart, and the natural counterpart has a history of safe usage. If the, let's say for example, let's take an example like tomatoes. If the GM tomato is substantially equivalent to a natural tomato, and a natural tomato is deemed to be safe, then there's no need to provide special regulatory treatment for the GM tomato. Now, the Royal Society of Canada in, I think it was 2003, questioned both the scientific and logical premises of this argument. However, what that led to was very little systematic testing and very little regulatory special treatment for foods containing GM products. After quite a lot of input from different biotechnology companies, various interest groups, scientific studies, and some limited public consultations, Canada's food agency and food regulations adopted guidelines for only voluntary labeling. What this has meant in reality is that those food producers whose products contain genetically modified organisms have opted to not label at all. This is despite consistent public opinion surveys that show about 80 to 90% of Canadians would like mandatory labeling. So the question is, who's responsible? And as I've mentioned, it's really a number of organizations and agencies, a number of groups lobbying very vigorously against mandatory GM labeling that has led to that result. My second area of interest is in country of origin labeling, and again, mandatory country of origin labeling. This is an area that I think in the next few years is going to result in some very, very major trade disputes. And in fact, one of them is looming between Canada and the United States. And so I don't have enough time here to go into all of the aspects of this issue. This is just a quote from the Minister of, basically from Agri-Food Canada and the Minister. As a result of the new legislation in the United States, which has led to, as of October 1st of this year, mandatory labeling of meat according to its country of origin in the United States. Canada has vigorously opposed this as nothing but a glaring act of protectionism on the part of the United States cattle ranchers and beef producers to keep Canadian beef out of the U.S. market. And you'll see here the minister, the agriculture minister expresses concern that there will be discrimination against Canadian products. The other move Canada has made is toward addressing the issue we were talking about earlier, which is that silly product of Canada labeling, which allowed the Chinese apple juice to be labeled as a product of Canada. What the Harper government has proposed is that foods processed in Canada that contain important ingredients will have qualified made in Canada labels that will more clearly perhaps indicate the origins of the imported ingredients, and that the product of Canada label will have to involve that the bulk of the content of the product is in fact sourced in Canada. What the press did not mention in covering this issue, however, was that these labels are not mandatory. So in fact, there's no obligation on the part of the company processing the food to have a label indicating the country of origin. And this is what the food industry had to say about the whole question of whether or not consumers should know where their food is, or the ingredients of their food is being sourced. I've just taken these from an article that came out from the CanWest newspaper network called Where Does Your Food Come From? And the author simply interviewed a number of spokespeople for these large corporate entities that we looked at earlier, and some of their arguments about why they should or should not be including country details on the country of origin of these various ingredients. And you can see that many of them are extremely reluctant to provide detailed indications of the ingredients and their origin, primarily because of proprietary and competitive concerns. And as the academic expert here from the University of Guelph indicates, in fact, they so often change food operators that we rely on these giant companies to buy the ingredients. And as many of the spokespeople for the corporations argue, we are important global brands. You should simply trust us to ensure the quality of our brand. This is where I'll kind of start to wrap up here and hopefully take some questions. What's the future in terms of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, particularly given all the food scares that we've heard about in the last year? Well, one of the issues that's come out both in Canada and the United States is the extent to which we really have the capacity to monitor our food system, given the extent to which that food system has become globalized and dominated by large corporate entities that have proprietary concerns about food sourcing. In fact, the reality is that the amount of food that is being sourced globally has gone up in a very, very high rate. I don't have a graph here, but if I graphed it, it would be a very steep line. At the same time, the budgets of the food inspection agencies that I'm aware of in Canada and the United States have actually not gone up, and in fact could be going down. So the estimate is that something like about 2% of the food products that are coming into the country are actually being inspected. And as you can see, what I've referenced here in this slide is a leaked memo from the Treasury Board to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, which I have a copy of, and which indicates that the agency will be required to make about 5% in budget cuts across the board. Now, this leaked memo came out before the election, and during the election, the Minister of Agriculture tried to indicate that this was not, in fact, a fait accompli, that there was still some discussions going on. And in particular, the most controversial element, aside from these budget cuts, was that the CFIA would be, in fact, relying on the industry to do more of its own inspections. The memo to the department spent a lot of time talking about the political sensitivity of these requirements and how they should be communicated to the public. So when the memo was leaked, the minister was trying to imply that they had not yet made a final decision. However, if you know anything about Treasury Board and the kind of directives that go out on expenditures, it's very unlikely that this is going to be subject to a lot of change in the future. The employee who found the memo on, I believe it was the CFIA website, and then leaked it, was subsequently fired by the department. And his union, CUPE, is now appealing that firing. So I think it's an indication of how they viewed the publication of this memo. And so we come back full circle to where we started from, which is, why do we want to know where our food comes from and how it's produced? And what I'm really arguing is that if, as consumers, we want to use our capacity to buy food to try and influence in some way how food is produced, whether it's because we have concerns about animal welfare, whether it's because we have concerns about the regulatory capacity of other countries where our food is being sourced from, whether we have concerns about food being locally produced or produced in an environmentally sustainable way, that requires us to know quite a bit more about the provenance of our food. Now, the interesting thing is that I think Canadians are really quite concerned about this, and these are some comments that were posted to the CBC Marketplace website after they did that sort of expose on food labeling and the Chinese apple juice. And what these people writing into the CBC, I think, highlight is the way in which, as consumers, our buying habits are an important element of the global food system. And so many of the people writing in are talking about the whole issue of using our ability as consumers to, for perhaps, privilege local food or privilege certain kinds of food. The need to educate ourselves and to work at many levels in terms of shaping our food system. And so I just want to end by indicating that as somebody who's studying this, I'm also very interested in what citizens as activists can do in terms of the food system. One of the things I've been involved in the Edmonton area is a campaign to look at using our purchasing power and also trying to ensure the preservation of local food producing systems. The campaign is called This Land is Your Land, and it involves lobbying City Hall in Edmonton, for example, to ensure that prime agricultural land in the greater Edmonton area is preserved.
And do you have any more?
GEA stands for the Greater Edmonton Alliance, which is a network of about 30 or 40 local organizations, including churches, unions, and a range of other community and non-governmental organizations that are working on a number of issues, including affordable housing and local food. One of the other things we can do is try and pressure government in terms of food labeling and perhaps making a case for the right to know more about where our food comes from and how it's produced. One of the global campaigns that directly challenges the global food system also involves farmers and small producers of crops. And these organizations are part of an organization called Via Campesina, the National Farmers Union of Canada, and one of the farmers' associations in Quebec are members of Via Campesina. And Via Campesina has a concept called food sovereignty, and I've just taken this from the Via Campesina website. Via Campesina argues that food is not like any other commodity traded globally, and that in fact food sovereignty should be the principle of organizing the food system. Food sovereignty argues that it is the right of communities to organize how they want to produce their food, and a system that would give priority to local production and consumption. Via Campesina's concept of food sovereignty, then, is one that would very much challenge the global food trade system and the global food production system. So Via Campesina is working to have this concept of food sovereignty more broadly accepted. I would argue that food, because of the nature of our need to consume food, is an issue about which citizens care deeply. And I got a sense of that when I was involved in the hearings before City Council in Edmonton, where we had 600 people come down to City Hall because they're concerned about local food. And it took the mayor and a number of councillors aback that citizens are that concerned about local food that they would in fact pack City Hall to the point where they had to have overflow rooms with video feeds. So I'll stop there, I think, and maybe turn it over to the moderator here and take some questions.
Okay, Mark? Thanks, that was very good. I have a couple of questions. One relates to the degree of integration of the North American cattle beef industry. Now, when I went to a seminar with Bill Diamond and Michael Hart last spring, they were making a point about the integration of that industry, and they said something like a typical cow in Alberta crosses the Canada-US border 9 times in its lifetime. So if the industry is that integrated, where does the pressure, first of all, is it arbitrary to designate what the country of origin is? And secondly, where exactly does that pressure in the industry have cattle moving up on both sides of the border, presumably have an interest in doing that? Where does all that pressure come for this ostensibly protectionist labeling?
Well, it's very interesting because you're absolutely right about the integrated nature of particularly the meat industry in North America. And if you actually look at the guidelines on the, US FDA website, you'll see that it's quite complex how they're going to implement this labeling. And there's quite a debate about the cost. And so they have this whole series of guidelines that about, you know, at what stage was the animal when it crossed the border, because you've got young animals crossing the border being fattened in the United States and then being slaughtered. You're quite right, it's very, very complicated. And there's quite a debate about how well they're going to be able to implement it. So the industry is displeased. The food processing industry is displeased. Where the pressure comes from in the U.S. is from, I think, the smaller ranchers in the U.S. who have been fairly effective lobby group ever since the finding of the first BSE cases in Canadian cattle. They've really seen that as an opportunity. And I have some sympathy with the Canadian government argument that these are largely protectionist interests. However, there is also a consumer movement for country of origin labeling, and their target is not necessarily Canada. Their target is, you know, the Chinese orange juice, and the some of the food scares, some of the food scares that have emerged. The problem is, and I think this is a problem Canada's going to have, one of the things I'm working on in this project that was part of a book on agri-food and global governance of food is about the discourse, the power of different actors in shaping the discourse around food. And the large corporate actors have a lot of instrumental power. They have very deep pockets and a lot of money, and they spend a lot of money lobbying. But one thing that the consumers and the environmental activists have going for them is the discourse around transparency and the consumer's right to know. It's awfully hard to tell consumers they don't have a right to know where their food comes from. It's hard to justify that. And so you've got this combination of certain protectionist interests and these kind of consumer movements and the food scares that have persuaded Congress as part of the Farm Bill that they should move to this country of origin labeling. Canada, Argentina, and a number of countries have already signaled, and the food processing industry in the U.S. have also argued, this is a violation of the WTO rules. And so I have no doubt this will result in a dispute at the World Trade Organization.
Yes. Melissa, I just wondered if you could speak to what do you think will be the most efficacious means of resistance? Because you noted that 80 to 90% of Canadians want food labeling. But governments, both the Liberals and the Conservatives, have ignored that. Does this movement really have to go strong to have an effect? Or really, really effect will come from people just opting out of the current system and starting more and more to buy local food? I mean, will withdrawal be the means of starting some pressure, or people put the pressure on directly, or a combination of those two?
Yeah, we should clarify that 80 to 90% want mandatory labeling of GM content of food, because of course we have labeling of food. We have labeling of food in Canada primarily for nutrition and health and safety reasons. Yeah. Well, what's happened is there have been efforts on the part of consumer and environmental groups, in particular the Consumers Association of Canada and Greenpeace, to lobby for mandatory labeling. There have been about three bills in the House of Commons. The most recent one failed in May by a vote of about 100, and I think it was about 140-some to 101, I can't remember the exact. So there has been the traditional lobbying that's been going on. But what's also happened is exactly what you've suggested, a withdrawal from what we might call the mainstream commercial food system. And the withdrawals occurred in two ways. One way is through the rapidly increasing market share of organic food. And that has been a response as the only way consumers can be sure they're not getting GM products. And organizations like Greenpeace have extensive details on their websites about what foods on the average supermarket shelf contain GM products. It's about 70%, the grocery producers of America argue, and I think that's probably right. So for people with income who can do it, they've been sort of voting with their feet and going into the organic food stores and organic local producers. The other thing that you've got is the kind of local food movement where people are arguing for small-scale local production and the preserving of a local food system where you can talk to the farmer or you can talk to the person producing and know exactly what is going into their crop, how they're producing their crop. So those, it's occurring on two levels, the traditional lobbying of governments and regulators, and then the withdrawal from the traditional mainstream retail food system.
Can I make a comment there? I have an offset question.
Well, it's a follow-up to Elizabeth just said, that there has been a big increase in organic farming and the sale of organic food, but
I think the GM question is a very minor part of that. I think the dominant reason, probably 80% of it, is more related to preservatives and herbicides and things.
Oh yeah, I think that's true as well, sure.
Lyle Grant has a question. He typed in, can't see it on the window there, but he wants to know if the major political parties have stated position on food labeling, especially genetically modified.
Actually, they do, and I don't have the material with me, but I can certainly reference where you might want to go to see their positions. Prior to this election, a number of environmental and consumer groups surveyed the political parties and asked them a number of questions about a range of issues, one of which was GM labeling. And the results of that were posted on an organization called CBAN, CBAN.ca, as I recall. And the responses to the questions are listed there. My recollection is that it's the Bloc Québécois and the New Democratic Party that are basically in favor of mandatory GM labeling. I believe it was a Bloc member that introduced the most recent bill that was defeated in the House of Commons, and the previous one that was defeated about 2 years ago was introduced by an NDP member. The Liberals and the Conservatives, by and large, with some exceptions of the odd member, are in favor of voluntary labeling. I think there may, however, be some Liberal members from Quebec who may have voted in favor of the legislation as in favor of the defeated bill. But by and large, the two largest parties have both been in power at periods where the key decisions were made to not label or to have a very sympathetic ear to the biotechnology and food processing industries which oppose labeling.
There's also a question from Wendy Benson, who you can read there, but basically the Canadian prairie provinces have the capability to produce huge amounts of food, far more than our small population can or should eat. How can consumers balance our agricultural capabilities with the trend to local food movement around the world?
That's a very good question. Clearly, our prairie farmers are very export oriented, and there are real concerns about the ability to keep other markets open for our products. The reality is, I don't think we'll ever meet all of our food needs locally. Simply, if we're in the interests of a balanced diet and the nature of our climate. However, the whole question of market access is a very, very tricky one for our food exports. Because we have varying regulations around the world about, for example, GM products, we risk, as we go into certain GM crops, being shut out of other markets. For example, I don't know if it's happened to Canadian farmers, but it certainly happened to American farmers who are producing non-GM crops that have been contaminated. And when those crops got to the ports of the European Union in, for example, Rotterdam, and they were tested because the European Union has mandatory labeling, these farmers found that the contamination led to their crops being turned back, and they're now suing, I think, Monsanto for millions of dollars in compensation. One of the reasons GM wheat has raised such concern in Canada is that if we move to test widely these GM crops and they contaminate Canadian wheat, then that wheat may be shut out of major export markets. So there are a lot of questions. I don't think we'll ever reach a situation where countries will not need to import major crops. I think what the food sovereignty movement argues and what the local food movements argue is that there should be space for local production. And to use a term that's very popular at the WTO and the international organizations, there should be policy space for countries to make decisions on issues like labeling that, if they choose to privilege local producers, could privilege local producers. The concern of the food sovereignty movement is that organizations like the World Trade Organization, as they set rules in favor of the global food system, will make it difficult for national regulations to provide that information to consumers and to ensure that there's a space for local food production. And so I think it is a matter of balancing, and I think there are always going to be crops that are going to be imported. The question is, what kind of restrictions are going to be put on national food regulatory regimes to allow them to at least provide consumers with information and to ensure that there are indeed still local food supplies?
Okay, I'd like to make a couple of questions or comments. I was interested in the whole food sovereignty thing because I just spent time yesterday translating the Declaration of the Forum of Indigenous Peoples at the International Society or Congress of Ethnobiology that was held in Cusco in Peru last June. And food sovereignty and, what do they call it anyway? It basically, sustainable sustenance were big issues for the global indigenous delegates to that forum. And incidentally, the Cusco region in the Andes declared itself to be a GMO-free zone. It is, of course, the home of the domestication of the potato. So they have many hundreds of varieties there. Still, 500 varieties were grown in the fields of one of the villages that we visited, which is kind of a boggling concept to think of 500 distinct varieties of potatoes. Anyway, yeah, it is really an issue around the world, that whole business of food self-sufficiency. Now I forgot what my second thought was. I've been thinking about things like farmers markets and things like that in terms of local food production. You know, how much can we actually manage to know that we're producing or eating local food, say, in Edmonton? You know, I go to the farmer's market and I know who those people are, but then if I go to the store, where's that all coming from?
This is a huge issue, actually, is the whole question of, aside from the question of sort of mandatory labeling, is the extent to which when we go to retail outlets in Edmonton or in Calgary or wherever we are, the extent to which even the people involved in the retail end know where the food is coming from. And I like to give the example of working with the Greater Edmonton Alliance. We've been doing what we call local food audits, where we go to major retailers in Edmonton and ask them about where certain products come from. And you'll find, first of all, that they're very careless about labeling, and secondly, that they don't know. I went to a store in Edmonton and found, I thought I wanted to buy red peppers, and I thought, well, I'll buy as local as I can. It was a time of the year when one would expect there to be peppers, at least from British Columbia, in the stores. And the bin of peppers contained peppers from Canada, Mexico, and the Netherlands. And I was stunned that we were importing peppers from the Netherlands. When I asked the store manager, couldn't you at least separate them so I can tell whether I'm buying Netherlands peppers or peppers from British Columbia, because I'm rather concerned about all that transportation. His reply was, I don't know which peppers are which. They all just come off the truck. So if, you know, your manager at the retail local level doesn't know, it's very, very difficult for consumers in the big retail outlets to know where the food, even the locally produced produce, to know where it is and to be able to identify it in a store. Now, there are a couple of stores that are starting to, again, for their own marketing reasons, starting to claim they're shopping local. I think the new Sobeys in downtown Edmonton is making that claim. They recognize that consumers, increasingly with our concerns about climate change, transportation, sustainability, the quality, the pesticides, the things that Norman was talking about earlier, that people do want to know about their food. But on the other hand, I think the economics of the global food system are such that they're not you know, they're not there yet.
Wendy also has a follow-up question. She'd like to know a little bit more about the VIA Complementary CNA. I posted the website, but wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I'm not the expert on VIA Campesina. There's, in fact, a very good, I think she's a political scientist at the University of Saskatchewan whose name escapes me, but I could certainly, if you email me, I could probably get back to you. VIA Campesina is an organization that was founded, I think, about 15 years ago, basically to give voice globally to the situation of smaller farmers versus sort of agribusiness factory farming. And it's formed, I think, as a result of a food and agricultural organization sort of UN conference where input was being sought from civil society on a number of food-related issues. And there was a feeling that this voice was largely absent. So a number of peasant farmer type of organizations in a number of countries, I think, got together at this UN conference and decided to form this organization. And then had a lot of kind of internal debate and discussion among their composite members from all over the world and came out, I think, in about 1993 at a UN conference with this concept of food sovereignty. So they've been around for, as I say, I think about 15 years or more, but they really formed as a result of being very frustrated that the voice in terms of global food issues, the voice of the small farmer was not being heard and was in danger of really being drowned out and overwhelmed. And in many parts of the world, these are in fact indigenous peoples, particularly in parts of Latin America. But if you maybe contact me, I could certainly send you the name of the Canadian author who's written most extensively on VIA Campesina.
Thanks, and Liz, I put your email address up there as well for those that may have questions afterwards, and Erica's question.
Thank you for the presentation. It's a very interesting this question, but I was wondering, do you elaborate here about your thesis,
maybe it would probably be best if I tell you how I got involved in this. I got involved in this through someone asking me to look at the Codex Alimentarius, which is this standard, international standards body, because of its increasing importance in terms of international trade issues, because I had done work on the World Trade Organization and issues of transparency in trade negotiations. And they said, maybe you could look at transparency in terms of the Codex and the way in which powerful food corporations influence the Codex. So I was part of a project that started out sort of arguing that that basically many of the international rules on food trade are heavily shaped by powerful corporate actors. And so the idea was that we would look at different case studies in different areas. And mine was the Codex Alimentarius and food labeling rules. And initially I was looking at GM food labeling. And so the thesis was large corporate agribusiness is influencing national governments and then these international bodies to set rules that favor their interests in the case of biotechnology and food processing, which would lead to have only voluntary labeling. Well, the reality is that at the Codex Alimentarius, despite concerted efforts of countries like Canada, the U.S., and Argentina, and the biotechnology and food processing industry, they've in fact failed to stop the movement toward mandatory labeling. More countries since they began this effort are now labeling, and the Codex, although it has been deadlocked and cannot agree on mandatory food labeling, continues to address the issue despite the fact that Canada keeps trying to kill it and get it off the agenda. Our original thesis was that many of the international trade rules are shaped by powerful corporate actors. But what we discovered that there are different kinds of power, one of which is discursive power in terms of framing issues. And what we found is that in parts of the world, consumers and environmental movements, particularly in Europe, reframed the issue of labeling and GM labeling and were successful in getting mandatory labeling. As a consequence, the battle at the Codex Alimentarius is one where the large corporate agribusiness that opposes mandatory labeling has not been able to get its way. So I guess my thesis is that there is very much a political struggle, and that the most powerful corporate actors have not been as successful as one might have expected if one has a very narrow view of power. So I guess that's a long discussion of what I should probably find a more succinct way. But really what we're looking at are questions of power and who influences international trade rules on labeling.
Just to supplement you, what countries have been successful in terms of mandatory legislation and why?
The countries of the European Union, countries like Norway, Australia even has some labeling requirements, even though it's a major food producer and exporter. A number of developing countries, and this is quite interesting, as the battle has gone on at the Codex and at the World Trade Organization, a number of countries have been fearful about their own market access to other countries. So, for example, some of the smaller countries in Africa and elsewhere that want to retain access to the European Union market have got on board for mandatory labeling because they want to be on the same side as the EU because they're exporting to the EU. So there, despite what I initially thought would be the real power of the biotechnology industry, which is very concentrated globally, and the big food exporters, it's in fact the trend has not necessarily gone their way, and that's what led us to start thinking about a more nuanced way of looking at questions of power in international trade rules and global governance.
Sort of naive comes to the question here, but because we're all getting so wary and suspicious of food, I'm wondering who regulates the organic labeling and the fair trade? Because when we're buying a new product, I think we all ask, well, how do I know? How do I know that that's really organic, and how do I know that it's a fair trade coffee?
In the case of organic, this is an area that the Codex has also been looking at. Some countries do have national regulations. The United States has national regulations on organic foods. Canada does not yet, and I think maybe Norman could correct me on this, Canada is seeking to develop national rules. What you see very often on Canadian products that are called organic is they are following U.S. FDA organic. So if you look at the label, you'll often see meats, U.S. FDA organic, da-da-da. So it's kind of odd that, you know, a Canadian might be following U.S. rules. But that's because the U.S. has developed rules. Canada has not yet developed rules. That's slightly different from fair trade. Fair trade is a new type of labeling which has also emerged, which is another area I'm interested in, but it's a huge area. It's what is called third-party certification. What this refers to is the desire of consumers to be assured that a product is produced in a way that they find ethical or acceptable to them, such as you know, buying garments that are not made with child or sweatshop labor. And what happened is, again, because global production systems are so, they're so global and they're so integrated, there's a lot of subcontracting that goes on, for example, in the garment industry. So you as a buyer of a certain, of a Gap article of clothing, have no way of assuring yourself that that subcontractor didn't use sweatshop labor. So what's happened is corporations have sought, in the interest of getting around consumer concern about their brands and about the ethics of the way their products are produced, have sought neutral third party, kind of like auditors, who will certify that that product is produced in an environmentally sustainable or an ethical way. So for example, you have a Forest Stewardship Council, an independent third party who certifies that the wood that Home Depot sells is not made from old growth trees. That's an example. Fair trade began in a similar way with a desire on the part of development organizations like Oxfam to find a way around the global, the corporations that control the global coffee trade. And there's a wonderful film called Black Gold, if you haven't seen it, about the global coffee trade. And what they were concerned about is that the actual coffee farmers were getting very, very little for their product. Most of the value of the coffee product, of the $3 you spend for the latte at Starbucks, goes to the middlemen, the big corporations, the Nestles of the world. So they began to look at a certification process which would create a coffee label that basically takes the money for the coffee and it goes directly to the farmers in the form of cooperatives, and the farmers get much better value for the coffee. Then they encourage consumers at the other end to buy the coffee. But in order for you to do that, they had to create a label. And the label has a whole bunch of requirements for certification. So if you want your coffee as an Ethiopian coffee producer to get the fair trade label, which gets you a much greater return when the coffee is sold in the supermarket or in the store, you have to follow the fair trade labeling guidelines. And you have to grow the coffee in a certain way, you have to share out the profits in the cooperative in a certain way, etc. So it's what's called third party certification. And it's either done, in the case of organic, there are now national regulations, government regulations in the U.S., but in the case of all these other examples like fair trade, they're independent organizations that certify that this coffee is being produced and marketed in a certain way to give you the assurance as a consumer that the money you're spending on the coffee is going to the coffee producer.
If they're independent, though, aren't they open to bribes? If they're independent, then isn't that aren't they open then to bribes and all of that? If the third party independent individuals, I tend to have more faith in government, and I shouldn't, I mean, I know that, but I just wonder, well, who's there to certify the independent third party certifiers?
Yeah, this is not my area of expertise, but I have, I think, a bit of a sense of how it works. Basically, the third parties, what I mean by a third party is usually some kind of a nonprofit foundation or entity which actually hires, you know, auditors, and there is quite a lot of transparency in the sort of auditing process. It's not in their interest to falsify because, of course, once you betray trust in a brand, you've destroyed the brand. And so, in a sense, if you're a part of the fair trade labeling system, the whole reputation of the brand is based on the fact that it follows these guidelines. And they're followed quite rigorously. Now, one of the problems is that that's not a problem. Bribery is not a problem. The problem is, in fact, the opposite, that they've become so diligent in this certification that the paperwork burden on a small farmer, particularly in a developing country, is very, very heavy. The standard for fair trade is so rigorous that there's a mile of paperwork that you have to do in order to achieve certification as, say, a coffee co-op, that in fact the paperwork's actually quite burdensome on some very small farmers. And I think one of the advantages of being part of co-ops is that they can spread a bit of the burden.
Just want to point out that Wendy Benson's drawn attention to the fact that the organic food labeling standards will be in place December 2008.
Yeah.
It's also true that there's quite a bit of organic third-party certification. If you look at products, global products that are available at both the supermarkets and in places like Planet Organic. It kind of reminds you of all the things that certify something as kosher. You get these little logos from little organizations that says this food is pure and it's okay for you to eat it.
That's in fact where there is a lot of third party halal meat, kosher. These are all other examples of certification.
And there is a recent scandal about kosher meat. I was not the kosher where they concluded that somebody was serious in violation and hence well.
Question. I went to Save On Foods and I was looking for organic tofu. And I was told by my fitness instructor dietitian that it really should be organic because so much of the soybeans are genetically modified.
Yep.
And I asked him around, and now he wasn't a senior manager who spoke to me, it might have just been somebody working for me. He just said, don't worry, none of our stuff is genetically modified. And I was kind of surprised by that because I thought, you know, food generally and soybeans specifically were high degree genetically modified. Do you know anything about the degree of penetration in the market? I probably should have asked your senior manager.
Yeah, the question is about Mark being reassured by a local manager in a food store that the tofu produced from soy in the store did not contain GMOs because we don't have any GMO tofu. In fact, soy is one of the crops that is very heavily invested in GM, and in fact, a lot of the soy coming out of Brazil is GM soy, as I understand it. I would not, my own experience from asking store managers about, you know, where their food comes from and their knowledge of it is questionable. There is, you can go on Greenpeace Canada website, and they have a listing of all of the foods, the retail foods in Canada, the types of products that do have GM. I'm surprised at them saying that because my understanding is that a lot of the soy that's produced in the Western Hemisphere is GM.
And they might make the argument that if you really want to avoid GM, you can just buy organic.
Yes.
Like saying you have to spend a lot of money on
that. That argument was made to me by somebody I interviewed at the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. When I asked the question about, you know, consumers wanting GM labeling, and I said, does it concern you that the only option they have if they do have concerns about GM is to buy organic? And she said, no, that's evidence that the market works because, you know, organic is increasing its market share. So she obviously had no problem with it at all.
Great for professors.
Well, that's the obvious concern is that the price premium that organic food commands makes it difficult for those who have concerns but who have less income to make those choices. So
I would suggest that Mark gets another fitness instructor who doesn't give him bullshit advice on nutrition when obviously he's grossly ignorant of the subject.
You mean genetically modified is okay? In terms of that, and we're, antioxidants or whatever.
Well, if your life expectancy on regular soya bean is 32.7 years, having Planet Organic stuff may shrink it by about every 25 minutes. If you don't mind dying 25 minutes earlier, at a saving of probably $20, $30 a week on your food budget, which you can then use that money for many very useful things.
Yeah. Which could belong there.
Precisely. Judiciously. I suggest you spend the money on vitamin D tablets and don't get off neurotic on GM.
How do you know the answer to that question? That's a hypothesis that they're doing studies over a number of years. They know the outcomes and making comparisons. In fact, there's very little transparency and there's very little known about this particular area.
There's a wide variety of genetic modifications.
Yeah,
there's a big issue in GM in this country, canola oil. That is one of the big ones, probably with by far the biggest product in Canada is GM. Really in Canada, GM and canola is almost synonymous. Because GM is such a huge part of, canola is such a huge part of GM in this country. In terms of the research, the amount of research, it's one of those issues where you get 10 opinions for every one bit of actual research. Sometimes you get that in some fields where one person does a study and that's followed by 10 review articles discussing it. GM is certainly one of those. I've certainly been following this for 10 years perhaps. I've edited articles on the subject, book chapters where people are giving their own opinions on GM. I have followed the debate carefully. Certainly there is a very serious lack of any hard evidence that anybody ever died from eating GM food. I don't think there's ever been a single documented case of anybody dying or having ill health as a result of eating any amount of GM food. It's really more based on speculation than anything. And probably a much more important question than the health question is economic issues. I see GM really as a way for certain companies to penetrate markets and increase market share. It's really more of an economic issue. I see it as being dominant over the health aspect. I think people who go and pay 50 or 100% more in Planet Organic are just totally wasting their money.
I've seen you there quite often.
Yeah, I do.
Maybe I can
make a pitch in
that. Why not? I do go to Planet Organic, and I'll tell you why. Well, I write these articles denouncing the supplement industry, and I get my information from Planet Organic. I go walking in there and talk to people and asking questions. And there are a few things that they sell which are worth buying here and there, like buns and a couple of other things. But I walk around and I look at the place, but I seldom ever buy anything. I don't buy anything from Planet Organic. That's my research, is looking at it and trying to see how much they overcharge compared with Save-On Food and the way they market supplements. This is where I get my information from. I write book chapters based on walking around Planet Organic and observing what they're up to.
Could I just comment on something that Norman said that is actually quite important? And I want to just point to the fact that there are other issues around GM food not necessarily related to safety, one of which is the whole question of biodiversity. and the other is corporate control of patents. And I would strongly recommend you, if you're interested in this issue, to go to the Erosion Technology and Concentration website. I think it's etc.org. I'm not quite sure. But if you type in Erosion Technology and Concentration, it will come up. And this is an organization that's been tracking the development of the global seeds patenting issue. And huge corporate concentration. We've gone from something like 14 seed companies, we're now down to 6. I think it's 6 or 7. Monsanto's gobbled up one of the next biggest ones for, I think it was cotton, GM cotton seed. And so there are real questions around the almost oligopoly and maybe verging on monopoly control of GM seeds, and the whole question of corporate concentration and the ability of small farmers to not be captive of these giant corporate conglomerates, because of course Monsanto sells, you know, Roundup Ready canola, and then they sell the Roundup. So there's a whole broader question around GM, both in terms of biodiversity and in terms of corporate control and the patent system. So I think there are other reasons that consumers may not necessarily want to consume GM products above and beyond the whole question of safety. And I don't think we want to lose sight of that. And this whole question around biotechnology and corporate control is one that really, really concerns organizations like Via Campesina and small peasant farmers.
Your point about biodiversity is well taken in several ways, and it would be probably my primary concern of things like GMO crops. I mean, one is agrobiodiversity, because a huge number of the plant varieties around the world have been developed locally and are well adapted to local conditions and often require low inputs of energy, pesticides, etc., and still manage to yield. Another one is about food waste, which is to say the kinds of traits that you are selecting for when you do these things that are designed to be grown in massive monoculture fields in Canada and the U.S. may not be the culinary characteristics that work in traditional food ways. So for example, in Mexico, varieties of corn are incredibly important. It was domesticated there 9,000 years or whatever ago, and you know, people, it's tied up in very specific characteristics of corn, its color, its texture, its starch content, and sugar content, as well as its ecological requirements and growth, are all tied up with the kinds of foods that you need to make from it. You know, you want white corn, not yellow corn. You want something that's going to make a decent tortilla or whatever and have a certain type of flavor. And those things are at risk, that adversity that relates to people's identities and you know, cultural food ways as well, with this concentration and homogenization of foods and the pushing of a limited number of GMO foods, and you can't save your seeds.
Jeff, you say that Southern Norman, as if she had just repeated what she had said.
So
those were good points. So this goes, what you just said there, goes miles beyond health-related issues. These are much broader than that. I mentioned one or two, but you're wider than that. These are under the wider heading of non-health issues. GM, the issue of GM is when people think of GM, they tend to think of, oh God, we're being poisoned, maybe there's these proteins and I'm going to be allergic to proteins and I'm going to die from anaphylactic shock or something from the terrible proteins that have been taken from one plant and stick in this. There's no evidence of that working, but where the people who are opposing GM are on much more solid ground is on issues, local varieties being blamed, and economic control. But I still, from what I've read, that economic issues are dominating the equation in what why Monsanto wants everybody to have GM products. The golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rule.
I was wondering, if there are something, you know, like the GM company do a lot, then, the corona office cannot really more equipped with the new technologies to identify the causes of the health problem or of death. Like, for example, like Olympics,
it's a good scientific question. You can't prove a negative. Can you provide definitive proof that GM is safe? And the answer is, of course, no, you cannot. Absence of proof is not proof of absence. On the balance of evidence of people getting research grants, I'm sure there's people in America and England and places doing research on this and testing this and shoving it in rats and all sorts of things like that. If there were hazards, I would expect somebody to have reported it. Because peanuts are by far not the leading cause of food allergy. Far, far and away they are the leading cause of food allergy. It's nothing to do with the protein content. It's the type of protein. The type of people are allergic to protein. And for some reason, peanut protein very, very commonly sparks allergy, especially in children. And therefore, if one was looking to somehow enhance a particular food by using GM, it would be total economic madness to look for that peanut as the donor.
So even if you found a food like peanuts that where you could transfer allergy through genetic modification, you're saying just solve the problem by avoiding that? I mean, it's kind of like the exception that proves the rule.
Well, yeah, peanuts would be the absolute worst thing to use, but people use the gene from one species and stick it in another species. Now, in theory, there are the possibilities of black tomatoes. Often, there's many, many cases people are allergic to tomatoes, so that would theoretically be a possibility. A gene from tomato shoved into rice, for instance, could cause a tomato allergy in somebody eating the rice. That's theoretically possible. But if that happened, usually allergies are so easy to diagnose. The symptoms of an allergy are so absolutely obvious that it would very, very quickly be recognized.
Okay. you've just eaten rice, and 3 hours later, you're getting sick, and you know something's wrong here.
For the Canadian government, that would be the only basis to justify mandatory GM labeling, is the risk of allergic reactions.
Not the risk to monarch butterflies from GM cotton. I mean, that's one of the problems with a lot of the GM that, you know, Bacillus thuringiensis stuff into plants to make them require fewer pesticides. I guess it's more for corn. The pollen blows, and then the monarch butterflies all die because they happen to be caterpillars too on their nests. And so that's part of another aspect of the biodiversity question is, you know, are we that much better than when we were spraying the pesticides if we put out toxic plants?
Yeah. That's a good question.
Looks like we're about done here, and I would like to thank our speaker for an excellent talk and thank everyone for a lot of the debate. So, end the session formally, yes?
Yeah.
And we have a scheme to go off to the 9th Street Bistro and follow.
How many were offline?
There were 11 at one time.
Oh, were there? Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, oh, that's very nice.
Oh, yeah.
You might just run this.
Yes.
Thanks to those off site, and that concludes our broadcast. Bye now.